This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
And so it may be a little disorganized. I sense this was happening for Walter as well. You know, it's sort of other random comments, right? So there's going to be a lot of random comments here, but I hope that this will be helpful and help us further explore this dynamic that is the human story, the story that was intended not just for our own flourishing, but the flourishing of the creation. Oh, I have to say, Walter, that thing about Antiques Roadshow is so powerful, because here are these artifacts created with tremendous skill in very rich, thick cultural contexts originally, that have been kept, sometimes unknowingly, sometimes knowingly, by other human beings, tended, cultivated. And the idea that that started out as a kind of deep, expert appreciation of the value in the true sense of these products of human making, these human beings taking the good creation, making it very good in all these different ways, tools and toys and arts and chairs and, you know, whatever it is, and that it's been reduced to turning it into this fungible stuff, countable, fungible, storable power, which is what money is, as if it would be a good trade to trade this rich, beautiful connection to human making and keeping of the world for countable, fungible, storable power. That identifies so precisely the idolatry of our time. And so I'm going to steal that metaphor and use it liberally in future presentations and weeks. Just very powerful. Leanne Payne, who was an odd and great teacher of the spiritual life, she died last year, said something that has been one of the most influential things ever said in my presence, in my own spiritual life. She said, "We either contemplate or we exploit. We either contemplate or we exploit." In every encounter, even with inanimate things, even with just the created world, if I do not pause to contemplate, to open myself, what is this that is before me, this reality before me, above all in the presence of another human being, if you and I meet and, you know, say you come up afterwards and you have a question to raise or a fear to express or an objection to offer or, you know, whatever, all the reasons that we engage after these talks, and if I, in listening to you, immediately jump to how am I going to answer this person, and I don't just contemplate you, which is a vulnerable thing to do, just to contemplate you, I will inevitably, in one way or another, use you for some purpose of my own, rather than reverencing you for who you are, whatever pain, grief, joy, and delight has brought you to this encounter. And of course, you with me as well. And learning to contemplate is one of the essential practices of the Christian, of the human experience, right? But it is the thing we skip over. And Antiques Roadshow went from contemplating to exploiting. There, you have a commenter. Leanne Payne, L-E-A-N-N-E, and then Payne, P-A-Y-N-E. We either contemplate or we exploit. And this is really what idols invite us to do, not to contemplate the world, not to enter into the world openly with vulnerability to the maker of the world and the possibilities of the world in all of its abundance and its order and structure, but simply to jump right to the question, how can this make me like God? And how can this make me independent, allow me to declare independence from God and ultimately cherish the hope that I might not surely die? So idols, to review from yesterday, promise us authority without vulnerability. That's why we seek them, and they initially work. But over time, the idol ceases to deliver. And so there's kind of a line, which I think I have a little laser here. I can even point out the line, maybe. It's being very faint. I think I may need new batteries. Never mind the laser. There's a line between idolatry and what I've called poverty, those many words you could use for that lower right. Because the thing that promises us authority without vulnerability ends up generating vulnerability without authority. There's actually a profound connection between those two corners of this diagram. And this is the basic deception of idols. But as I just hinted yesterday, and as I want to explore a little more now, there's an equally good word and a parallel word for life up and to the left, and that is the word injustice. Because it is not just idols, inanimate things. Trying to get my slide to do what it's supposed to do. Would someone make a small offering to the gods of technology, and then I'm sure they will start working for us again. Come on. You can do it. Maybe you can't. Let's try this. There we go. All right. See, this is polytheism. I have one way to control my presentation and another one. So this god failed me. Out with you. On to this god. Get it done. However you get it done. That's why polytheism ends up happening. It's like, well, that god didn't work out. Let's try this other one. All right. So, injustice is simply a description of a social condition in which some human beings have the opportunity for a season, perhaps all too long a season, to live with a great deal of authority, with very little vulnerability, always at the expense of, it's like a law of how it works, always at the expense of other human beings living in vulnerability without authority. I have sometimes thought that there is something like a law of the conservation of vulnerability in human systems. You know, the conservation of momentum is the idea that you can't get rid of it. It has to be transferred from one thing to another. The reality is life in the world is vulnerable. And it is actually intended to be that way because that's the only way that the abundance that comes with flourishing can happen. So if I decide to shed vulnerability, that vulnerability is always shed onto another. Perhaps the created non-human creation, but almost inevitably also felt my fellow human beings. My choice, if I have the choice, if I take the option and have the power to live without vulnerability, inevitably outsources that vulnerability to others. But it does so in an asymmetric way. And I want to tell a story that I hope might illustrate this. I have a friend named Gideon Strauss, who was born in South Africa. And Gideon, for a time, was the director of a very important and wonderful think tank in Washington, D.C. called the Center for Public Justice that attempts to think in Christian frame but in a public voice about the challenges of justice. And Gideon was coming through town and offered to him to host just a dinner in our home, or kind of a gathering in our home, partly as a fundraising thing and partly just for our friends and neighbors and supporters of the Center for Public Justice to get to meet Gideon and talk together. And so we had a lot of people packed in. We have a pretty small first floor, and it was packed with about 25 people, 25 to 30 people. And Gideon asked the group a question as he began his presentation. He said, "When did you become interested in the topic of justice? When did that become a topic for you?" And it was actually an amazing experience to go, and he had everyone go around the circle. And the great surprise to me was that almost every answer around the circle, as people told their stories, it involved an experience, often a direct encounter, with violence. Now, this was kind of a suburban fundraising event. And a few moments before we sat down in that circle, you would have thought this was a group of quite privileged, as it was, quite prosperous, as they were, reasonably diverse, racially and in other ways, group of, you know, just successful Americans. And yet, when you asked them to talk about justice, everyone had a personal story of violence. And we came around the room to a physician, an Asian American physician named Abby, I'll call her Abby, who was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years younger than me. And she told her story, and her story began this way. When I was 8 years old, my family moved to a town called Needham in Massachusetts, outside of Boston. And I got very excited because Needham is actually where my family moved when I was 13, and it's where I came of age, it's where I came to faith. I have all these wonderful memories. It was a very rich, generative place for me, and my parents have moved since then, but Needham is still, it is really where I think, if you ask me where I'm from, I think I'm from Needham, even though I actually only lived there during high school, but high school is significant years. So I kind of did the math, and I realized, okay, so This would have been while I was living in Needham. Abby moved to Needham as a younger girl. I thought, this is so awesome. Someone who even knows where Needham is. This is going to be fun. We'll talk afterwards. And she said, there was a convenience store in Needham called the Little Peach. And I thought, I know exactly where the Little Peach was. It was directly across from the United Methodist Church, in the context of which I came to faith. And almost every day after school, it was just down the road from the high school, my friends and I would go to the Little Peach, and I would get Orange Crush, which I haven't had in a long, I don't think I've had it since high school. But as she said the Little Peach, the memory of the flavor of Orange Crush, like, arose in my mind, and a desire for Orange Crush. I was like, well, that would be awesome to have another one of those. Do they still even make it? I have no idea. So, the Little Peach. I mean, I was in the Little Peach every day. I was like, this is so cool. Here's this person in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, far from Boston, who knows Needham, knows the Little Peach. She said, one day, I went into the Little Peach with my father, and he needed to make a couple copies of a document. And there was a copier in the back of the store, you know, 10 cents a copy or whatever, back in the day when these were not common. They didn't have scanners and that kind of thing. She said, but my father was Chinese, born in China, and was not comfortable in English. He and my mother had immigrated. She had been born in the U.S., but her parents had immigrated. My father was never comfortable in English, and he got very confused about the instructions of how to operate the copier, and had to ask the proprietor of the Little Peach to help. She said the man became very angry at my father, began mocking his Chinese-accented English, took the papers from him, and ripped these papers and threw them on the floor and said, get out of my store. Abby said, I had always seen my father as strong, kind, smart, he had a doctoral degree of some sort, this resourceful, committed man who provided for my family. And suddenly I saw my father belittled and mocked and ashamed as we walked out of that store with the pieces of those valuable papers. And she said, I had never known what racism was. And after that, I knew. I never knew. All those days, all those afternoons in and out of Little Peach. Now, I will say I never thought of the proprietors of the Little Peach as especially friendly people. I mean, they were just, normal sort of New England people. I had no idea that that kind of violence, not assault and battery, but nonetheless verbal and physical violence, done to a human being's dignity happened under my nose in my town, in that little place. And roughly 30 years later, Abby still remembered that. And an experience like that would bring her to a conversation about justice. Let's think about what happens in that moment. What is it to be an immigrant to the United States? It's to take, actually, in many cases, a great deal of authority, as Abby's parents had. It's authority and vulnerability. Talk about meaningful action. We're going to, and Anne spoke to this last night as well, we're going to risk everything, so great vulnerability, but we're also going to meaningfully act, go to this place where we hope for greater opportunities for our kids. And so here is really a family that is seeking flourishing, and seeking it with a lot of integrity, judging by her account. But the proprietor of this store, out of prejudice, decides to take on a position of extraordinary authority with no vulnerability, because he has the power of being the proprietor, he has the power of being white. Who in Needham even would even believe or credit a story like this, even if he went and complained or tried to tell the story? And what that generates is vulnerability without authority. It reduces a human being, at least for that moment, to a situation akin, though not in extent, perhaps, to poverty. But it's asymmetrical. It does far more damage to Abby and her father than it benefits that angry man. What benefit did that guy get from his petty exercise of power? Minimal. Temporary. it gave him one little sensation of superiority, and then it's gone. Abby still carries that wound with her today. The wound goes far deeper than the benefit to the possessor of power and privilege. There's something asymmetric about this, and this is why in any system of injustice, only a relatively few benefit. There's only one way for everyone to benefit, and that's for all of us to seek authority with vulnerability and vulnerability with authority. That generates flourishing. That multiplies power, actually. But when you set up the world along this upper left to lower right axis, it's asymmetrical in its effect. It doesn't benefit the power and the powerful as much as it harms the dignity and capacity of those who are oppressed. Let me tell you another story. So that's a very personal, individual story in a way. I'm going to step one step out and tell a somewhat more systemic story. I think I have a picture to go with this. This God is now also failing. I see how this is working. Wow, okay. So, it's not serving me the way that I expect it to, that's for sure. Let's try one more time. Click, click. I may have to be, well, look at that. And now it gently gives you injustice. How about that? I'm actually going to go on to this gentleman. This is Jayakumar Christian. Jayakumar is the head of World Vision India. So he leads that massive Christian humanitarian organization's efforts in relief and development in that nation. Has about 8,000 staff. He travels with a single kurta. He's the head of this massive organization, and he wears this same simple brown kind of linen kurta every day. He's the most joyful and relaxed human being I think I've ever met in my life. And a great expert and a very influential leader around the world in issues of poverty, development, and the way that the gospel shapes these things. And so I had gone to do an interview with him for CT. It was published in 2007. And I thought I was just going to meet him in his office, but when I emailed him about our meeting, he said, actually, I want you to come on a trip with me because I want you to see some of the work that we're doing. So we got on a train, which is in the background there, and went about 2 hours west of Chennai in southern India, where Jayakumar lives, to a district called Gudiyattam, a district of small villages out in southern India, where, for time out of mind, as long as anyone could remember, children had been enslaved. When World Vision first began engaging with this district, 80% of school-age children in the district were not in school. They were instead in effectively modern-day slavery. There are 35 million people enslaved around the world today. There are more people enslaved today than were trafficked across the Atlantic in the 400 years of the slave trade to the Americas. And of those 35 million, many are in India. And they are enslaved because of what's sometimes called debt bondage. It might sound a little familiar if you've been paying attention the past few days. So there was a list in one of the village offices of children who had been enslaved. Now, they had been released. This story has a very extraordinary ending, so there's a good news ending to this. But what happens is a family, so let's take the first child here is named Prabhu. Prabhu's family is very poor, and a great urgent financial need will arise. It might be a medical need. It could be an honor obligation like a wedding or something like that, that the honor of the family demands a certain amount of investment. They don't have the money. So they go to the proprietor of a small business who has a certain amount of working capital, and he says, well, I'll loan you the money. So in this case, Prabhu's family went to a cycle shop. This is not a bicycle shop. This is a motorcycle shop. It's dirty, dangerous work to repair and tend to motorcycles, but there's someone who has a business doing that. And the owner of the business, who has this working capital, has cash, says to the family, well, I'll give you a loan, absolutely. You'll just have to pay it back. And so the loan, in this case, was 3,000 rupees, which at the time was about $50, a $50 loan. The family takes the loan, uses it for whatever happens to be the need, And then they have the challenge of repaying the loan. The problem is these families are not only illiterate, they are often innumerate, and so they aren't really given any capacity to understand the terms of the loan, and the interest rates are usurious. They're in the 50 to 60% a year range, if not more. And so while they've been spending the money and preparing to pay it back, the interest has been accumulating at a very rapid rate, the family doesn't have the resources to pay it back in any case. And in fact, the money lender knows this. He's not actually in it for the payback of the loan. He's in it, ultimately, for the child. Because what happens after a certain amount of time, as the money lender's henchmen put more and more pressure on that family, one day the henchmen come and they say, you clearly cannot pay this loan back. If you can't pay it back, we will make sure you're thrown in jail, because the police are being paid by the moneylender. But you have that 8-year-old back there. What if you sent him to work for the moneylender? He could pay back the debt, and we'll write down your debt. What they don't disclose is that what the moneylender actually will do is charge room and board and other made-up fees for the maintenance of the child to the family's account. So the debt will actually grow faster after the child is working in that cycle shop than it was before. But the family has no other choice. They are highly vulnerable. They have very little authority in this situation. And so they acquiesce, and Prabhu is taken out of school, starts doing this dirty, dangerous work. A man who will exploit a child for labor will exploit a child in any number of other ways. And the family's debt only grows and grows. And that is modern debt slavery, actually. It's debt slavery in any time and place. And Jaikumar said something to me on the way out to Gaudiyatam. It was another, actually, along with what Leanne Payne said, this might be my other candidate for the most influential thing ever said in my hearing. It's not quite as pithy. He said, Andy, I want you to understand what you're going to see when we get to Gaudiyatam. He said, you're going to see poverty, but you need to understand, poverty is not actually primarily about a lack of money. It's not even really just about a lack of political power. He said, poverty is the result of someone playing God in the life of someone else. Someone or a group of people playing God in the life of another person or group of people. And I realized that what the moneylender was doing is the same thing the idol does. Here's a family that needs some authority. Okay, money is storable, countable, fungible power, authority. They need that. They go to the moneylender. He says, I'll give you authority. Here it is. You got it. Very big payoff. 3,000 rupees is a lot of money to that family. And so right away they get the benefit. And oh, there will be some interest, but you know, you can pay back the loan. But over time, the benefit of that loan is quickly diminishes, is quickly spent. The demands increase until finally, whatever that urgent need was, is in the past. It was spent well or poorly, may depend on the family, but it's gone. The money's gone. But now the demand comes for what? The child. And now this child is taken off the path of flourishing, is taken out of the context of flourishing the family, and is now a commodity. And I realized this is the same thing as idolatry. It's just that instead of an inanimate object being ascribed with this capacity to give you authority without vulnerability, but delivering vulnerability without authority, it's just a human being who steps into that place and says, if you serve me, work in my way, you'll get what you want. But this idol cares nothing for the flourishing of that family. This God player cares nothing for the flourishing of the child. All he's in it for is to accumulate to his own quite petty benefit. And in one small village, in which there might only be 30 children, 20 of them at one time had been not just working in cycle shops, working at looms, making matches, beady work. Beady is a rolled cigarette. So actually more than half of these children had spent their days, instead of flourishing, had spent their days rolling cigarettes to be sold in the local market. It's like idolatry on top of idolatry. And as I pondered this, I realized this is why there are two things that over and over God is said to hate. God hates idolatry, and God hates injustice. And the reason he hates idolatry and the reason he hates injustice is they are actually the same thing. They are the corruption of the image of God. And it's a very specific kind of corruption. It's the introduction into human life of a God substitute that purports to tell you what God is like and how to be like God and how to not surely die, that actually misrepresents God and in doing so destroys the ones who actually are the true images of God. And whether that is an inanimate thing vested with a kind of wishful hope and worship by a community like an idol, what we call an idol, or whether it's a person or the representative of a system, Pharaoh, who offers that, it really doesn't matter. Because in that village in India, the image of God is lost. Which is to say, it's actually lost in two ways. On the one hand, if you go into that village before World Vision arrived, and in this system that had been functioning in that village and in many, many places in India for as long as we know, and you say, who in this village looks like God? Who do you think in that village seems to be like God? The moneylender. Like, he's got power. He can do things. He can make decisions. The other powers are sort of subject to him. The police and law enforcement powers are kind of at his beck and call. He's got henchmen. He's got the ability to shape his world. He's got authority without vulnerability, but we don't really think that's what God is like anyway, because the only picture we have of God, the only one with any capacity in this system, doesn't act that way. So this must be what God is like. So on the one hand, that's a complete distortion, complete falsification of the true God. And then the other place the image of God is lost is, of course, in the poor. Because if you ask that family, do you bear the image of God? Wouldn't you expect they would say, you've got to be kidding. They would say that if they were like North Americans. I don't know what they would say in India. I don't think they would say, you've got to be kidding me. They would say, I can't even provide for my own son. How could I possibly bear the image of God when I can't even tend my world in such a way as to provide for my own children? And so God looks at a world that was meant to be full of image bearers. He says, my image has been doubly misrepresented. It's lost in the oppressor and it's lost in the oppressed. And both now do not image me as they are meant to. And so the world that God sees and that we see is a world that looks like this. Namely, it's missing the image. It's missing the divine image. There's a blank where that flourishing is supposed to be. Instead, we have the vast majority of people living in poverty, some able to withdraw to safety, and a few, for a time, profiting from idolatry and injustice. So, where does violence come from? Here's what I've been thinking about violence. I'm trying this out. I don't know that this is all right, but I'm trying it out. I wonder if the real root of violence is not frustrated idol worship. So if I am an idolater, in the unlikely event that I might in any way be implicated in this myself, and I turn to something, it could be a drug, it could be a habit, it could be another person, it could be a system, and I say, you will give me what every human being secretly wishes for, godlikeness without dependence, authority without vulnerability. And I take the idol's bargain, and it initially delivers. The problem is, it doesn't keep delivering. So now things are getting shaky in my world. I'm starting to feel the scarcity that Walter talked about. I'm starting to feel nervous because the idol is not paying off in the way it did. And so what am I likely to do if I have sufficient power? I am very likely now to resort to more and more coercive means to extract from the world, to exploit out of the world that which I think I truly deserve, but which my idol is no longer giving me. And so violence is, first of all, the lashing out of frustrated idolaters who no longer receive from that idol that good thing they thought it promised, and now will take it by any means necessary from anyone vulnerable enough not to be able to resist them. And then I suppose that perhaps in a kind of terrible return, those who find themselves living in great vulnerability without authority may then themselves Theoretically, another arrow should appear going back the other way. I apologize that my technology is so distracting to you and to me. I may have to wander over and click every once in a while. That now, it's not just violence that goes from the perpetrators of idolatry and injustice towards what we would call very generically the poor, but then it might be that if you were in such cases of vulnerability without authority, that you might decide my only resort in order to get the good things I am intended to have as a flourishing person is myself to resort to violence. And so the cycle of violence ultimately is driven by the worship and the pursuit of not of bad things, because we're made for flourishing. We are made to be like God. We're in the image of God. We are not made to surely die. If you eat the tree of life, the whole point of the tree of life is God doesn't want his image bearers to die. In the midst of a mortal creation, his image bearers are supposed to have access to the means of flourishing life. Oh, thank you. Oh, wow. Thank you for serving in that way. That's great. But instead, what is left is a cycle or a return of violence. Violence that originates with the idolater, the powerful, but that then is returned because it's the only option for communities that live in great vulnerability. Feels like the only option. One more thing to put, we can go to the next slide, just to put privilege on the map here. This is an important word, I think. In a way, what privilege does, I think of privilege as the accumulated benefits of past exercises of power. Privilege is the accumulated benefits of past exercises of power. And what privilege does, inevitably, is it insulates me from risk. As I accumulate in my retirement plan, as I accumulate certain kinds of status, there are many different forms this takes. As I benefit, it's interesting. I can benefit from beneficial exercises or malevolent exercises, and it still ends up being privilege for me. It still ends up insulating me from risk. So it really doesn't matter whether my ancestors were good stewards of the farms that they tended, which they were, primarily, or if they were implicated in the system of slavery originally in the American South and then in the continued subjugation of persons of African descent in the South, which they were. All that power, all that privilege, all those accumulated benefits come to me in a single package, and I cannot unpick which of those came because of the very good image bearing of my ancestors, which there was some, and the idolatry and injustice that my ancestors benefited, which there was some. What it all does, it's like this headwind or tailwind, depending on how you look at it, that blows me away from vulnerability. And either I can go up to the left and use that in action in the world, or I can just retreat. But either way, I'm ceasing to risk. And the thing about privilege is it's almost always unconscious. I'm usually not aware of the tenth of what I have. And power that is unconscious is almost never used for flourishing. Power is meant to be used for flourishing, but when power is unconscious, when it takes the form of privilege, it's almost always used for self-protection or for amplifying my authority in the world without vulnerability. What's the next? Oh, I know what the next slide is. Yes, let's bring that up. So let's talk about this for a minute. I've been going on for a little bit. Why don't you turn to a neighbor, and as whichever question seems most pertinent or both, where do you see injustice? And let's try to think fairly locally about this. Walter's helped us see potentially big systems of this, but let's think relatively locally. Where do you see some people having authority without vulnerability at the cost of others having vulnerability without authority in your community or your city, neighborhood, school, or church? And then of the three corners of broken image bearing, where do you find yourself? We all are in these corners at different times, but where do you find yourself the most often? So just turn to one or two neighbors and think out loud about those questions for a minute or two. All right, finish that thought. And finish that sentence. I hate to stop you because I often think this is where the most learning happens, probably. So let's share a little bit of what we're learning with each other. What came to mind? As brief as you can be, just in the interest of hearing from many people. Yes?
In small church.
Wow. So the moral of this is always try to be the senior pastor. Oh, no, I don't think that's actually probably what you meant. No, it's a system that can tend, if that privilege, you might say, is not tended it very carefully, to end up exploiting rather than leading to flourishing for everybody. Yeah, great. Other examples, yeah. Yes. So an important insight there, and the last part of this morning will obviously be, how do we engage in restoring the image, is that you're going to have to think about how to grant authority to people in communities that currently live without it. That's going to be the key question. What will allow, as there's this influx of people who bring a kind of a tidal wave of privilege in, and there's nothing, by the way, there's nothing wrong with the benefits that come from the exercise of power. In and of themselves, they are good things. But it's when they insulate us from risk and insulate us from our vulnerable neighbor that they become problems. And that's tending to happen. So you're having to think, as someone who wants to come alongside communities of vulnerability, how do I help converge and increase their authority to match, in a way, the authority of those coming in? Often the unconscious, although sometimes very blatant authority. That's great. Yeah. Wow. So it's easy. It's, you know, part of the problem with bringing up the topic of privilege in a majority audience, as this audience is majority, although I'm thinking we're going to have to stop calling it majority culture because it's not going to be the majority much longer, but you can still call it dominant culture. Part of the problem is we tend to just feel so guilty about it once we become aware of this. It becomes quite paralyzing. But the truth is that is a resource that's available for flourishing if you'll put it at risk. And so the reality in dominant culture organizations is that dominant culture people need to risk some of their power to make issues really topics of concern. And if they don't, it's often very hard for it to get traction, as you said. Yeah, beautifully put. Yes. And so here, the legitimate, order is a part of flourishing. And so a disordered community is not a flourishing community. And so there's a proper instinct that we need to find a way to order our common life. But when that's used when that's used without correspondingly increasing the authority of the vulnerable to flourish in their own way, then it becomes just subjugation. Yeah. And so those codes of order, rather than serving abundance, end up just serving the protection of a very sanitized and new, sort of depressingly neutral space. I mean, when you see a community that's really been taken over by community covenants, there's this sameness to it. Like you've got three paint chips you can use on the exterior of your house. And some of you live in these places maybe, but I just will say, I don't think that's the flourishing that's meant architecturally. It's not. Did I? I must have struck a nerve that I didn't know I was going to. All right, just one more example, maybe. Yes. Sorry, I have to pick between you, but yes. Could it be the case that you could spend untold sums on your children and still be sacrificing your children to an idol? And could it be the case? It could be the case. So the question for the next few moments, how will the image be restored? This then becomes the question. God looks at a world that was meant to be full of image bearers, and what he sees now is a world that is empty. We have never, in one sense, none of us in this room has ever seen a human being. We've never seen what human beings were meant to be, a human being fully alive. We have never seen it. None of us. We've never been it. We've never seen it. And God says, not only is my image lost, but the portion of the cosmos, the heavens are the Lord's, but the earth is for us. The earth that I entrusted them is being laid waste. Everything is diminishing. Nothing is flourishing. What's going to happen? Well, this is the story of Genesis 12 to Revelation 22. And God's first image-restoring intervention is to create a people who will be the most vulnerable people in the ancient Near East by many measures. They are not a great empire like Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, whichever one is ascendant. God says, I didn't pick you because you were the biggest people. You were the smallest people when I chose you. That's, I think, an intentional choice of God Choose a people who inevitably are going to be vulnerable. The location that God gives them is a highly vulnerable location. I think of that strip along the Jordan as the truck stop of the ancient Near East. Like, all the commercial routes go by there. It's of tremendous geopolitical interest then and now. And God says, I'm going to give you this wonderful territory flowing with milk and honey, but also of interest to every empire that's ever going to arise in the history of the region. Highly vulnerable. And yet, what people have had more authority, capacity for meaningful action than the people of Israel to this day? Who has more influenced the course of history than the people who received the law at Sinai and began to try to live in relationship with that God? Unbelievable authority, completely out of proportion. This is Walker Percy. He says, what do you make of the Jews? This kind of sounds politically incorrect the way he puts it, but he puts it very forcefully. He says, you got to account for the Jews. There's something weird about the Jews. Every empire tries to eradicate them, and now Babylon is like three layers down in the archaeological digs. Who talks about the Assyrians? But we still have the Jews, because they have a relationship with the one who is authority and vulnerability, but who has been more vulnerable as a people into modern times than the people who bear that gift and burden of being the chosen ones of the one who is all authority and all vulnerability. And we know that Israel never fully finds itself able to entrust itself to this authoritative, vulnerable God. And so they're always making side agreements with whichever regime of idolatry is connected to an empire of injustice around them. And my theory about why the Jubilee year probably was never observed is the Jubilee year is the ultimate expression of the doing of justice, the restoring of shalom, and the rebalancing of authority and vulnerability in the community. It's the like big kahuna of image restoring. And the reason that Israel probably did observe the gleaning laws to a great extent, did observe the Sabbath, maybe had a few sabbatical years, but never managed to do the Jubilee, is the Jubilee is the most demanding, most comprehensive instantiation of image restoration you can imagine. And that would only be possible if your heart as a people were completely devoted to the God who is generosity, abundance, and justice. And always they, like we, were sort of making side bets. Does that make sense? That was God's hope for Israel. But Israel finds itself fatally compromised with idols and injustice. And the prophets talk about these two as if they're the same thing. And they'll turn on a dime. And we, in our modernists, especially post-fundamentalist modernist split at the beginning of the 20th century, we think, well, justice is a political thing, and some Christians care about that. And idolatry is like a religious thing, which God do you worship? And other Christians care about that. And we read the prophets, and we're very confused. We're like, why do you keep switching? Isaiah, in one verse, we'll talk about, you know, the figurines of silver and gold, and in another verse we'll talk about land distribution. And we're like, hey, you're switching topics. It's religion and politics. They don't mix. But God says, no, this is about my image. The one who dishonors the poor dishonors my image. They're not disconnected in the way that our Christian traditions in the last 100 years have disconnected them. They are the same thing. And this cuts both ways. So if you're of a more mainliner, liberal, progressive, whatever you style yourself bent, and you hear that, you're like, yeah, you fundamentalists need to care about justice. That's true. If you're a more fundamentalist, conservative, evangelical, whatever you want to call yourself, you're like, yeah, see, we need to do evangelism. Well, that's also true. Because it's about the restoration of relationship to the one without relationship to whom the image will never be fully expressed. Because you're always going to be playing some God. The question is not whether you're going to play God. Actually, the question is, which God are you going to play in the world? We say playing God as if it's a bad thing. But actually, you don't have a choice about whether you're going to play God. You're an image bearer, whether you like it or not. The only question is, who are you imaging? And you're either imaging an idol, or you've been restored to relationship with the true God, and you're now imaging in the world the true God's capacity for authority, the true God's capacity for vulnerability. And so, in the last days, after in many ways the project of Israel has at least fallen short, another comes who is an icon. And an icon is a trustworthy image. An icon is an image that actually reveals reality, ultimate reality, unlike an idol. Idols and icons are both images, but an idol directs you in the wrong direction, sends you on the wrong path. Whereas an icon tells the truth And so Colossians says Jesus was the icon, the icon of the invisible God. And the Orthodox who portray Jesus in the Pantocrator icon do something very remarkable with his face, which is it's asymmetrical. It's not drawn as human faces tend to be, kind of balanced right and left, because if you hold your hand up and hold it in such a way that you see only Jesus's, the right side of Jesus' face, that is, it's the left as you're looking at it, his right, you'll see one expression. And then if you move your hand so that now you see the other side, you see a very different expression. How would you, someone articulate for us, how would you characterize the two expressions of Jesus, the right side of Jesus' face, the left side of Jesus' face? What are you seeing? Can anyone name it? Confrontation and comfort. That's a beautiful way to put it. And wonderfully alliterative, which means it must be true. So the Jesus' left side, my right, as I look at him, the eyebrow is arched, the eye is stern, the gaze is quite confrontational. But Jesus' right side, as I look at his face, the eyebrow is relaxed, the eye is more open, the gaze is comforting. The authority and vulnerability of Jesus are represented in the icon. His authority to judge a world that has fallen short of his plan for image bearing. His vulnerability in compassion towards those who come to this icon hoping for a word of hope from it. Jesus imaged God. Only one human being in the whole story since its terrible fall has lived with complete authority and complete vulnerability. Jesus has more authority than any human being who ever lived. When he said, "Do this in remembrance of me," they actually did it. None of us will get our great-great-great-grandchildren to do anything we wish they would do. We don't have that kind of authority. 2,000 years later, we're still symbolically and hopefully really washing each other's feet. We're still eating the meal. Jesus had more authority than any human being in history, and he embraced every possible vulnerability. And our Western art tends to shy away from portraying this, but the Romans crucified their victims naked. Because that's how you ultimately shame a person. You expose their vulnerability and you immobilize them, displayed to the world. And that is who Jesus was willing to be. And everywhere Jesus went and everywhere his body now goes, flourishing happens. One place Jesus' body went was to Gudiatom. And with Jai Kumar, I got to meet some of the girls and boys as well. I have a picture of the boys too, but I want to tell you about the girls. Or one particular girl, who a year before I met these girls had been in bonded labor. They'd been slaves, not in school. Now they were in school. A couple of them are wearing their school uniforms. They got out of school for lunch. And I got to talk with the girl kind of in the middle through a translator and ask her a few questions. And so I asked her what she wanted to be when she grew up. And she said, "Well, I want to be a doctor because my village doesn't have a doctor. So I'm going to go off to school and become a doctor and come back and be my village's doctor." I thought that was pretty good. So then I was trying to think of what else to ask her. I said, "So what do you do after, like, what do you like to do once you're done with your schoolwork? What do you do for fun, in the afternoon?" And she said, "Oh, we free slaves." I said, "Can you say a little more about that?" And she said, "Well, there are still a few children in our village who are in bonded labor." It was down to about 5% at this point. But there are still a few children. So after school, my friends and I go, and she said, "We go to the moneylender, and we tell him, you can be thrown in jail for this." And that was now true, because World Vision had worked to restore the systems of public justice in that community. So that the police actually enforce, this is all illegal, all this bonded labor stuff, totally illegal everywhere in the world. But the police don't enforce it. Well, now the police were enforcing it. So we tell him, "You could go to jail. You need to stop." Talk about authority. And then she said, we go to the child and we say, "You do not have to stay here. Come with us tomorrow. Come to school. We'll get you in a uniform. We free slaves." And I realized I had just met my first 12-year-old abolitionist. And I told Jayakumar about this on the train on the way home, and his face lit up, and he said, "This is how I know it's time for World Vision to leave this village." He said, because she didn't say, "World Vision frees slaves." She said, "We free slaves." And he said, "I would have been very concerned if she said, World Vision frees slaves," because he said, it's possible to play God in a benevolent way. He says, "I represent incredible power. I have Western donors. I have connections to the highest level of government. I can come in and I can easily replace a malevolent God player with me and with World Vision. But the structure of poverty would not change in that case." He said, but now that she said, "We free slaves," they now have authority without vulnerability. One of the most amazing things I saw there was this thing called the Children's Panchayat. The Panchayat in India is the village council. So they had a children's version. And they got the children all to sit on banana leaves in the clearing once a week and just talk about their village, talk about what their hopes were for it, talk about how to take care of it, what they wanted life to be like there. They were restoring authority in that village. It's not a bad... all right. I could show you another thing, or I could stop. I have no idea what to do. That's a vulnerable thing to say. Can I do one more? It's totally different. I want to show you a picture. All right. But let me just say, it's like sometimes the speaker in me is like, "Ooh, I found a great ending." And sometimes I would end here. But I think it's worth saying, it would be awesome, right, if what we became known for as a church is we free slaves. We free slaves. We free the victims of injustice and the victims of idolatry, the victims of addiction and the victims of oppression, the victims of all the false gods of our world, and those who have been ground under, and those also who have enslaved themselves to the benefits of their privilege. And the mission of the church is we free slaves. That would not be bad. All right, I'll show you some art. What kind of art would you make if you were an image-restoring people? That might be a way to think about this. Oh, I have so many different things I could show you. I think I'll tell you a personal story. I could show you something that is not personal to me, but let me try something that is. Let's see if it shows up. I showed you Mako, actually, the other day, if you were here. I want to show you two artists whose work has intersected with my life and tell you a story of how it intersected with my life, just as a parable of, just on a small scale, how we might be part of the restoration of the image in our world today. Mako Fujimura is a contemporary art who draws on the Nihonga tradition of Japan, one of the great artistic traditions of Japan. He himself is Japanese-American. But he also draws on the abstract expressionism of the American 20th century. And he creates these extraordinary works that really do embody order and abundance, the kind of beauty and flourishing for which we are made. And if you ever get to meet Mako or hear Mako, please take the opportunity, because he is someone who actually embodies flourishing, authority with vulnerability, incredibly vulnerable. His own vulnerability was brought to a clear moment when the day that he was in his studio in Lower Manhattan on September 11th, 2001, and his children were in school one block from the World Trade Center as the planes hit the buildings. And by grace, or whatever you might attribute it to, Mako and his family were all preserved. But he found himself, as an artist, asking, "What do I do?" Working, literally working, within steps of Ground Zero. And it has changed his artistic career and actually made huge contributions in his artistic career. And so Mako's work is always about both beauty and suffering, both simplicity and complexity. It's abstract. He will layer these incredible pigments that he grinds and crushes by hand. He says, "It's very important for me to crush my own pigments because it reminds me of the vulnerability of creation. As I crush that pigment, and if I'm going to crush it, I'm now responsible to make something beautiful with it." And so some of his work has moments of order, these gold squares of gold leaf, but then also moments of unpredictability, variety, surprise. I think I have one more of his. Sometimes there's just these this incredible use of rich colors. It's very hard to do justice to Mako's paintings on a screen because the pigments are layered in such a way that all their facets catch the light. So to be in the presence of one of Mako's paintings is to be drawn into this field of light and sparkle and depth. And in these paintings, Mako is trying to do justice to what it is to be a human being and to make redemptive art. A mutual friend of ours sent me a Facebook friend request a number of years ago. I was still on Facebook. His name was David Sachs, and he sent me this friend request. And I went through this period on Facebook where I refused friend requests from people I had not met in person. And I had not met David in person. And so I sent him back. I actually had this like automatic reply. I could copy and paste it. That, you know, just sort of a polite way of saying, I don't think we've ever met, so I don't really want to be your Facebook friend until we're real friends. So I sent it back to him, back to David Sachs. And then I learned that he's my neighbor. Like, almost literally, about half a mile away from me, the Sachs family was living. And he knew of me through Mako, and he really wanted to be my friend. And so I thought, okay, maybe I should get to know this guy. And this is David with his wife Angie and their four kids a couple years ago now. And I discovered that David, like Mako, was an artist, although he was not a painter. He was a photographer and had actually ended up with an incredibly successful career, both as a commercial photographer and as an art photographer. And when I started to learn about David's art, I realized how crazy I'd been. I think I'd neglected his friend request for a year before I got to know him. And I realized, this is this incredible person with an incredible commitment to making beautiful things. And he's my neighbor. Here's somebody I can talk to. I don't know if you ever feel this way. I just sometimes feel in my town like there's nobody I can talk to about what I most care about. And I could talk to David about beauty, about faith, about agents, you know, about just the difficulty of writing and producing and so forth. Just the whole realm of what we did as creative professionals in a way. And so David became just a very dear and deep friend, largely just through his persistent commitment to our friendship. And so I got to know what he did in his spare time. Now, in his day job, he would do sometimes very typical commercial photography. His one shoot he did was for, like, Cheetos, you know, so he'd shoot Cheetos in glorious, you know, profusion. I mean, you know, whatever. But he used the authority that gave him to travel and make photographs of people in the world who are often not photographed in ways that respect their dignity. So I want to show you a sequence of David's photographs from the continent of Africa. And what David did in Africa was to make images that rather than boxing Africa in as a place that images only vulnerability, only poverty, only great desecration of the image, that actually discloses the image. And he really did make some incredible pictures that give you a sense of the radiance of God in the human form. It is interesting, this Hebrew word, likeness, seems to somehow suggest that even our bodily form, male and female, somehow is not incidental. Photographs of people who carry themselves with great authority. And maybe my favorite image that David ever made was of this woman. And you can immediately see that she has lived a life of tremendous vulnerability. But David captures her in a moment of ineradicable dignity and authority. He did beautiful work with color as well. One of his photographs, the sequence he did of children running on the roads of Africa, the freedom of a child running. And another one he did actually ended up on a cover of an exceptional book by a Nigerian priest that was actually an Oprah's book club selection. And so for a while I would go into the airport and see Uwem Alkan's books, they were one of them, and there was my friend David's photograph inviting people into this incredible selection of meditations on life in Africa and all its beauty and brutality. In October of 2011, a crazy thing happened in my life. Steve Jobs died of cancer, and the Wall Street Journal asked me to write a 2-page essay about the meaning of his life. And I got the assignment on a Thursday, and I was, I had 24 hours to write it. I turned it in on Friday, and on Friday night, my wife and I were going out to dinner with David and Angie. And that night, we had this amazing dinner where we opened up several bottles and just pondered the responsibility we'd been given, each of the four of us in different ways, to image God, even in very public ways and significant, influential places, and with this tremendous sense of humility. And just had a very meaningful time together. The Monday, the next day, my Wall Street Journal piece came out. Two weeks later, I guess it was, I got a text from David. I still have it on my phone. He said, I'm at Penn Medical Center. I've just been told I have lung cancer. Would you come to this room? David actually didn't have lung cancer. He had what's called cancer of unknown primary. That is, the doctors really don't know where it began. By the time it was discovered, it was in his lungs. It was also in his spleen, liver, and all the places cancer thrives. And the first days looked very grim. And I had the incredible privilege of walking alongside my friend David and Angie and their family, along with my wife. And to our great joy, the pretty intense combination, the toxic cocktail that we used to try to hold this thing at bay, actually did work for David in the ensuing months. And 2012 was a time of just the most amazing gift, where David lived with the utmost vulnerability, a lot of side effects, you know, all the stuff that comes with this, but also with the ability to continue to work, to continue to make photographs, to continue to love his family, and an amazing community gathered around this family in our county, our little corner of Pennsylvania. And one of the most amazing things that happened that year is that a bunch of David's artist friends decided to do an art exhibit to benefit the Sachs family. And so they reached out to all his friends in Philadelphia and New York, and they said, would you sell a work of art if we put on an art show? And they said, we're not going to have it be a charity thing, because artists are always asked to give away their work, and artists, like, they need charity. They're like the vulnerable, right? So instead, it was done as a standard agented gallery show where the artist gets 50% of the selling price, and instead of the gallery owner or the curator getting the other 50%, that 50% was given to David's family. So it both benefited artists and the flourishing of art and benefited the Sachs, and they called it, let's see if I can put this up. They called it Das Bomb. Come on, I want to show it to you. Come on. Will, do you mind clicking? You really have to see. It's just a little joke, but you'll see. Das Bomb, which sounds like this cool German thing, like, are you going to Das Bomb this evening? Yes. But it actually just stood for David and Angie Sachs Benefit Art Market. But it sounds so cool, Das Bomb. They found an open storefront on Walnut Street in Philadelphia, directly across from the Apple Store, the most prestigious location in Philadelphia, this beautiful gallery space. The owner said, I want you to just have it. Fill it with art. And so actually two floors of this gallery were filled with art by some of the top artists in New York and in the wider world. The design director of the New York Times contributed this piece of sculpture. There were works of abstraction by very noted artists. There were works involving frontal male nudity, so we'll keep going. And in the show, I looked at the catalog ahead of time, and in the show was a work by Mako. And I'm sorry that the sunlight is going to make it hard for you to fully appreciate this work by Mako, but he had titled it Lux Aeterna, which is one of the prayers from the Requiem, let light eternal shine on them. And Mako had offered this, and I learned that Mako, because Mako is very established, that Mako wasn't taking his 50%. That 100% of the sale price of this painting was going to go to the Sachses and their needs. And I've always kind of wanted to own a Mako. And I looked at the price, and it was $20,000, which is market price for Mako's work. And I thought, No way. We can't do this. We'll just go look at it in the show. So Catherine and I went that night. I want to tell you, it was one of the moments of the greatest flourishing I've ever experienced in my life. These two floors of this gallery, full of people, full of beauty, full of joy and pain. David was there with his little children. And it was just the most extraordinary moment of flourishing I think I've experienced, certainly in the 12 years I've lived in Philadelphia. USA Today got word of it. They wrote it up in USA Today. The word of this got all over. I got to the show with Catherine. We're looking at the art. It's just amazing. And I say, oh, let's go look at Mako's piece. So we go to find Luke's Aeterna. And we discover there's actually two pieces by Mako. There's another one called Luke's Aeterna 2. And maybe it'll show up, especially if Will assists. And I looked at this one. Now, so hard to show you on the screen. Mako's taken cobalt. He's ground it. He's crushed it. He's layered it on a canvas, on a white canvas, and then he's drenched it with water. And as the water evaporates and the canvas dries, these fractal patterns begin to form, which, strangely enough, are very closely related to some things my wife studies in physics, the physics of how these incredibly complex patterns emerge with no human intervention except to create the conditions. This beautiful rivulets of intense complexity, deep dark blue in person, and he's layered just a few distressed leaves of gold over this. It's a picture of many things, I suppose, a deluge, the flood that awaits every human life, the beauty that emerges out of suffering, the gold that shimmers through, the glory that shines through even darkness and death and pain. And for some reason, this one spoke to us in a way that the other work, which is also wonderful, had not. And so I said, Catherine, let's go out on the street. It was the same price. We don't have $20,000 to throw around, all right? Just so you understand, like, that's a large number for us. I assume it is for most of you. I hope, no, please do not tell my parents-in-law this story, okay? But I said to Catherine, are we in it with this family? Are we committed to this family? Of course we are. Are we going to give them whatever they need financially in the coming years, whatever happens to David? Of course we are. We'd already given money to support them, as had others. So are we going to give $20,000 probably over the course of our relationship with them to support them if David does not ultimately survive? Of course we are. And God was like, yes, of course, this is the truth. And I said, why not have a painting? So we went back in, maxed out the credit cards that I had with me. Went home, repainted a whole wall of our living room. There's an east-facing wall in our living room, and I've always thought I wanted it to be an icon corner. The Orthodox place their icons so that they can pray facing east. And I always thought we should make that into an icon corner and have some icons there. I had never gotten around to doing it. So we rearranged that, repainted it, because you should paint your house to match your art, not buy your art to match your paint, by the way. And a few weeks later, the painting arrived, and it now hangs in our living room. And to me, it is an icon. It's an icon of love, and what love costs, and what love gives. And what's so striking to me is it's like all gift. Mako gave the painting. We gave the money. And David and Angie, by inviting us into their moment of greatest vulnerability, gave us the community that could cherish something of this value and could see the world this way and could know the glory even in human pain. And in April of 2013, we buried David. And we continue to walk with Angie and the kids as they get older, and others do as well. But we have a painting. Would you use us? Would you use us, God, to restore your image in the world and to have the courage to imitate Jesus, who, though he was in the very form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking on the form of a servant, and humbled himself, even to death on the cross. And therefore, God, you have highly exalted him, the icon of the invisible God, and have given him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue confess in heaven and on earth and under the earth that this is who you are. This is the true God. That Jesus Christ is Lord. To your glory, O Father. May we image him and be in him as he images you and is in you by the power of the Spirit.